few years ago, a survey was carried out in America asking people how many of the Ten Commandments they could name. And it was found in this survey that more people could name the seven ingredients of a Big Mac than they could name the Ten Commandments. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to embarrass you this morning by asking you all to name the Ten Commandments. But I think out of the ten, there's probably one that most of us would find quite easy to remember. And not only that, we'd be able to say that we haven't broken it. And it's commandment number six, you shall not murder. We might confess to lying, stealing, coveting, dishonouring our father and our mother, misusing God's name. But murder, we put in a different category, even to idol worship and adultery. It's a sin that most people cannot imagine committing. So it must be the easiest commandment to keep, isn't it? I mean, surely all you have to do is avoid killing somebody intentionally. I mean, it can't be that hard, can it? Well, if that's our view of what it means when God says, you shall not murder, then what Jesus has to say to us here in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 might be quite shocking for us. So let's read it. It's starting in verse 21 of Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who has taken you to court. Do it while you're still with him on the way. Or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you'll not get out until you've paid the last penny. What Jesus teaches us here in this passage is very unsettling. In God's judgment, anger against others is no different to murder. And it's unsettling because while none of us would perhaps put ourselves into the category of murderers, all of us get angry. You might have even got angry this morning. You might have got angry with the kids or with your other half before you left the house. Maybe as you're on the road, you got cut up by a careless driver and there were some choice words mentioned. Perhaps a text or an email came through that really got your blood boiling. Or you remembered a conversation with somebody a few days ago and that anger rose up. We may not know what it's like to murder someone, but we all know what it's like to get angry with someone. I guess that we haven't committed a cruel, calculated assassination of another human being, but we may have committed a cruel assassination of someone's character. And what Jesus is doing here is getting to the heart of what it means to actually murder someone. What does it mean to murder? Is it merely an outward offence against another? Or does it begin with something deeper, with an inner offence? Well, Jesus is showing us that what lies beneath the act of murder is a wretched hatred, a spiteful contempt of another human being. And he wants us to see that this dark and deadly motivation is what lies behind God's teaching on murder. Now, why does Jesus need to do this? Why does he take the trouble to explain the true meaning of the commandment not to murder? And also the commandments about adultery, divorce, oaths, justice and love, which he goes on to cover in the rest of this chapter, in chapter 5. Well, the clue is in the way that these units of teaching are structured. If you notice from the headings as you look through them in the rest of chapter 5, they each begin with the phrase, you have heard that it was said, or something similar to that. And then it's followed by, but I tell you. Now, at first glance, it might seem like Jesus is contradicting the Old Testament. He's saying, well, this is what the Old Testament says, but I'm telling you something else. That's not what is happening here. That can't be right. Because just look back at verse 17, where Jesus says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. So we've already seen in Matthew's gospel that Jesus is the chosen one. He is the Messiah who has come to fulfill all those Old Testament promises. He is the one who has come to accomplish God's plan of salvation. As we saw last week, that didn't mean getting rid of the law. It actually meant fulfilling the law. So true believers, people who are truly part of the kingdom of God, are true followers of the law. For us, God's commandments aren't written on tablets of stone, they're written on our hearts. We don't observe the letter of the law, we seek to obey the spirit of the law. We don't try and get away with begrudging obedience to some burdensome commands. No, we delight in living God's way by God's rules. And that's what Jesus means when he says in verse 20, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not about outward obedience, it's about inner heart obedience. That's what Jesus is talking about here. And what follows in the rest of this Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' explanation of that verse, of verse 20. He shows us what it looks like to live out a Christian righteousness and not to live the way of the Pharisees in that legalistic righteousness. And he begins in verse 21 with murder. You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. And when Jesus says there, you have heard that it was said, he's talking about the understanding of the Old Testament, that the people were taught by the Pharisees. And what the Pharisees are trying to do, they try to make the law obeyable. Their goal, which was well-intentioned to start off with, was to make sure that people couldn't break the commandments and so face the judgment that previous generations had experienced, namely the exile. But in the process, they domesticated God's demands. They reduced God's holy law that was given on Mount Sinai amidst fire and smoke and that terrifying trumpet blast. They reduced it to a checklist, to a list of rules that you could just check off every time that you'd obeyed them. They were treating an untamable lion like a little kitten. That's what they'd done with the law. And so they reduced the law on murder to merely not killing someone. That's all that it amounted to, the law on murder. As long as you didn't actually end someone's life, you're obeying God's law. We sometimes talk about Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount as being radical and revolutionary, but actually, it's traditional. It's orthodox. It's what God meant the whole time. It's just it's been so badly watered down over the centuries. So when Jesus says, but I tell you, he's going back to the original meaning of the law. He's saying that this law is now fulfilled in me and in my teaching. And this is how you should obey this law. This is how you should follow it. So imagine it like this. You're walking along a footpath, and there's way markers at regular intervals to show you the way that you should go, so you know how to stay on the path. The trouble is, over time, those signposts have got moved, and now they're all pointing in different directions. So how can you know the way that you should be going? How do you know the right path that you're to take? Well, what if someone came along who claimed that they knew the right way? And they changed all the signposts back into the right direction. Well, you might be suspicious of such a person. I mean, what authority did they have to come along and to change all those signposts and put them in the direction that they say is the right direction? But what if that person was the creator of the footpath? What if that person was the one who originally marked it out and mapped out the route? Surely they would be the only person who could say which way that path should be followed. They would be the only person who could point those signposts back in the right direction. That's exactly what Jesus is doing here. He's saying, you think the way marker is pointing in this direction, but I tell you, it's pointing in this direction. This is how you follow this law. This law is fulfilled in me and in my teaching, and this is the way that you follow it. So no wonder that when Jesus comes to the end of his sermon in Matthew 7, that the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority. Not like the teachers of the law. He had authority. So if Jesus claims that, if Jesus is who he claims to be, if he is this pivotal point in history, if he is the fulfillment of the law, then we need to listen to him when he says that there's no difference between anger and murder. However much we may object, and however much in our hearts and in our minds it doesn't make sense, we need to listen to his teaching. I want to draw out two simple points from Jesus' teaching in these verses. The first is the dangerous consequences of anger, and the second is the urgent need of reconciliation. So let's first look at the dangerous consequences of anger from verse 22. So remember, here is Jesus. He's finding the wayward rambler, and he's now pointing us back in the right direction, which way we should follow. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. So that there's no difference between murder against another and anger against another, because both have the same consequence of divine judgment. That is the dangerous consequence of anger. It's the judgment of God. And Jesus does what any good preacher tries to do. He drives his point home by repeating examples to reinforce the point. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now, some have said that this verse represents a sliding scale of offence and consequence. But that can't be the case. There's no difference between being angry with somebody, calling somebody Raca, which is an Aramaic term of insult. It means imbecile, fool, blockhead, numpty, however you want to put it. And then calling somebody, you fool. It's the same offence, the same level. It's all showing contempt for another human being. That's what we do when we use those terms of offence and contempt against somebody. It's showing that you think that their life is less valuable than yours. You're looking down on them. You're saying that they deserve less dignity and respect than you do. And in doing this, you deny that they are made in the image of God. And that's exactly the same thought process that a murderer must go through before they kill somebody. It has to be. You have to be convinced in your own mind that the person you're about to kill is of less value than yourself. That you look down on them. That their life isn't really worth being kept alive. But you're justified in taking away their life. And Jesus is saying that's what we do when we talk with contempt and spite and hate against another. We're saying that their life isn't worth the same as mine. And just because we haven't gone ahead and pulled the trigger or wielded a knife doesn't mean we're not as guilty. And we're heading for the same judgment. Now, it might sound like there's a difference in the consequences that Jesus outlines in verse 22. But in reality, they're all the same. They're all places of God's judgment. The judgment that Jesus refers to for anyone who's angry with his brother, it must be God's judgment. Because only God can see that inner anger, that inner offence against another. And the Sanhedrin was the religious council. It was the place where God's judgment was meted out. And the expression fire of hell, it literally means Gehenna of fire. It's a translation of the Hebrew word for the Valley of Hinnom. It was a ravine just south of Jerusalem. And basically it was a local tip. It was a centuries-old dumping ground, complete with smouldering fires. It was a place where you take out your rubbish. But it also became a picture of eternal punishment. The place where the fire never goes out and the worm never dies. And as that term was used, people could imagine in their own minds this smouldering valley of death, the disgusting stench that came out of it, the terrible scenes that they would have seen if they would have peered over into that ravine. And it brought home the terrifying reality of eternal punishment. It's a reality that remains for us today. It's not just a picture. It is real. If we refuse to listen to Jesus' warning about the consequences of anger, then this is a real consequence for us. What makes hell so terrifying is that it's the place of God's judgment against our sin. I wonder if you believe in God's judgment. In your mind, is God's judgment real? Or is it just make-believe? Is it just something that the Bible talks about? But actually, it's not real. It's not a real place or a real reality. We no longer live in a society where God is the ultimate judge over all things, like it was in Old Testament times. Yet we do understand, I hope, that there are consequences for our actions. We've got a justice system that punishes all sorts of crimes, including murder. We can't get away with breaking the law, even if we think that law doesn't apply to us. Even if you think that Jesus has been a bit over the top here when he talks about anger being on the same level as murder. It doesn't matter. God's judgment is the one that counts. And in his judgment, anger is no different to murder. He won't let you get away with unrepentant, vindictive anger towards another. But perhaps you're okay with this teaching. I mean, you are a follower of Jesus, after all, and angry people should face judgment. Just I'm not one of them. I don't have a problem with anger, you say to yourself. I'm a calm, rational, level-headed person. I'm loving and gentle to others. Just ask other people. They could tell you. Another danger of anger is that it's one of those sins that we can easily hide away under the surface. We can easily deny it. It's an inner sin, an under-the-surface sin. And it only rears its head now and again. And we can fool ourselves into thinking that this isn't an issue for us. It might be an issue for somebody else, but not for me. In his book on the dangers of pastoral ministry, Paul Tripp, who's an American pastor and preacher, he begins with these words. He says, I was a very angry man. The problem was, I didn't know I was an angry man. I thought that no one had a more accurate view of me than I did. I simply didn't see myself as angry. I wonder if that describes you this morning. I wonder if you're blind to the anger that is bubbling just below the surface. The anger that which bursts out when you're tired or you're stressed, when that extra demand comes upon you that just takes you over the edge. When somebody does something against you that is so wrong and so unfair that you just burst out with rage. But the rest of the time you're calm, you're level-headed, you're rational, you're loving and gentle with others. Let's not be fooled by our respectable outward persona. God knows what goes on inside our hearts. He sees the anger within us. He sees those vindictive thoughts, that contemptible hate and spite that we have for others. He sees those motives that lurk below that nice shiny veneer on the outside. Is there a disconnect between your inner private life and what others see of you on the outside? Is there a difference in the way that you act at home to the way that you act at church or at work? Can you be gracious with another church member or charming with a client? Yeah, at home you can be rotten and irritable. I think this is something that particularly as men that we perhaps need to address. I know that I do. Jesus says, anyone who is angry with their brother will be subject to judgment. And this judgment is real. And it's terrifying. So with that in mind, there's therefore an urgent need of reconciliation for anyone who's angry with another. So let's look, secondly, at the urgent need of reconciliation in verses 23 to 26. So Jesus outlined and highlighted the problem of anger and its consequences. And now what he does is to show us how we should deal with it. And his teaching, as we should expect from Jesus by now, is so countercultural that it takes our breath away. Just look at verse 23. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. And verses 25 to 26 is another example, this time in the context of the law court. And again, it highlights the fact that reconciliation should be the top of our priorities. It's an urgent need that we need to sort out and deal with. And the reason why this teaching is so countercultural for us today is that in both examples, Jesus urges us to look at things from somebody else's point of view. Just notice that Jesus doesn't say, if you feel anger towards your brother, then go and be reconciled. Now Jesus says, if your brother has something against you, go and be reconciled. We live in such a self-centered society, a place in which what I feel and what I want to do, what I think is the most important thing. If someone disagrees with me, well, they can get lost. I'm going to fulfill my desires and my potential. And anybody else standing in the way, well, they can just get lost. And that's the theme tune that our children are being played over and over again. Because I want to. Because it feels right to me. I'm going to do it. Whatever the consequences. Whatever other people think about it. However much it hurts other people. It's a theme tune that many of us grew up with. And it's got stuck in our heads. It influences us in ways that we perhaps don't realise. This kind of thinking. But Jesus plays a different soundtrack as he teaches here on the mountainside. His song is one of self-humbling and self-denial. And the words are quite familiar to us. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the mourning, the meek, the merciful. Turn the other cheek, go the extra mile. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. And here in his teaching on anger, Jesus tells us not to remember how others have wronged us. So easy to do that, isn't it? We don't need to be prompted to remember how others have wronged us. Those thoughts just easily come up into our mind, don't they? No, instead, remember how you have wronged others. That's what Jesus is telling us to do here. If you want to deal with your anger, then you need to stop looking within yourself and start looking out to others. You need to realise the impact that your anger has on your relationships. You need to stand in somebody else's shoes and look from their point of view. Look at how your hate and your contempt impacts them. The problem with anger is the same problem with all sin. It's self-glorifying. It puts me at the centre. It makes me the most important person in the world. If somebody's done something against me, then I have every right to be angry, don't I? Surely it's them who need to apologise against me, not me being reconciled to them. But Jesus doesn't let us think this way. In his kingdom of self-denial and self-humbling, we're to stop obsessing about ourselves and how others have hurt us. And we need to start loving others. Or as John puts it in his first epistle, we love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he's a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen. It's 1 John 4:19 to 20. And that's why Jesus says that anyone who remembers that their brother has something against them should leave their gift at the altar and go and be reconciled. And the principle is this. You can't separate your vertical relationship with God from your horizontal relationship with others. You can't separate the two. They're linked together. If you're out of fellowship with a brother or sister, then you're out of fellowship with God. You can't claim to love God when you're not loving your brother or your sister. Someone who's made in their image. Somebody who God loves and gave himself for. Now this is tough teaching. This is hard-hitting stuff. And there's going to be times in our lives, and this may be a time for you now, when you're out of fellowship with another brother or sister. And that relationship may take time to heal. It may never heal this side of eternity. So I want to give two important qualifications on what I've just said, which I think come from the context of Jesus' teaching and also the wider teaching of Scripture. And the first is this: we're only responsible for what others hold against us when it's as a result of real sin and error on our part. Where do I get that from? Well, look back at verse 11 of chapter 5. Jesus says, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me." He doesn't then say, "Go and be reconciled with them." Because those people clearly have something against us. If they're insulting us, if they're persecuting us, then clearly they have something against us. But what does Jesus say? He says, "Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven." Jesus is telling us that if we're going to live out the righteous lives he's called us to, if we're going to be truly following him in his footsteps, then somebody will always have something against you. But providing you're acting in love towards that person, if they've got something against you and you're living righteously in Christ, then it's their problem. It's their responsibility and not yours. It's not your offence that caused the break in the relationship. And secondly, if we are responsible to pursue reconciliation, but we're not responsible for making that reconciliation happen. We can't change people's hearts. We can't turn them back to us. All we can do, if we've wronged someone and we realise that we've wronged someone, all we can do is reach out in love, humbly, trying to reconcile ourselves to that person, but then accept that that may not work, and to live with the pain of that reconciliation not succeeding. Paul says in Romans 12, verse 18, "If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone." As far as it depends on you. That's the key. Jesus had enemies that were never reconciled to him. And yet he did everything possible to make matters right with them. He even prayed for their forgiveness. So pursue loving reconciliation. Do it as an urgent need, as a top priority, but then leave the outcome to God. I fully appreciate that talking about reconciliation can be very painful. Broken relationships do take time to heal, and they may never heal. But if this morning you've been convicted in some way of your own anger against another, then I urge you to be reconciled to that person, to put things right. And if you're struggling to know where to begin, then let me point you back to the start of Jesus' sermon, where he says these words: "Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn over their sin. Blessed are those who, by God's grace, see the deadly danger of their own anger. And by that same grace, come to God for forgiveness, because they will be comforted. They will be forgiven. The kingdom of heaven is for such as these." The kingdom of heaven isn't for those who think that they're righteous, who think they've got everything sorted, who think that in every relationship, everything is fine, and the problem doesn't lie with them. No, the kingdom of heaven is for those who know that they've messed up. It's for those who realise that that sin of anger lies beneath the surface. People who know that they can't do anything themselves to rectify that problem, but that God has, through his Son, through his Messiah, through the one who came to accomplish God's plan of salvation. We're going to close shortly with a hymn which gives us a model of how we can deal with sins like anger. And it's called "Beneath the Cross of Jesus." And that's the place that we need to come to this morning. Whether we're struggling with anger or any other sin, we need to come to the cross. And the first verse tells us how we come to the cross. We come just as we are, with all our sin, all our anger. And our unworthy souls are won by God's grace and God's mercy. The second verse tells us how we're changed. We're no longer chasing our own selfish dreams. We're no longer seeking to glorify ourselves and worrying what is happening to us. No, we've been changed. We've been made one with each other. We've been reconciled with each other through grace alone. And the final verse tells us how we should now live as followers of Christ, as those who are walking in his footsteps. The one who had every right to be angry against others because of the way that others treated him. And yet he prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So let's live our lives beneath the cross of Jesus. Let's see the place where our anger and our sin has been dealt with, the place of reconciliation. Let's live lives that are freed from anger, lives that are marked by ongoing reconciliation with God and with each other.